The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas B. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas B. Gibbs is on the air.
Welcome to Mr. Constitution Hour here on KPRZ, KPRZ. Welcome. Glad to have you here. We are working our way through the Bill of Rights. We've gotten to the Second Amendment. So, Mr. Constitution Hour, Douglas V. Gibbs. I am Douglas V. Gibbs, douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com. Let's get started. The Second Amendment is where we're at, and it says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And that's a very important thing in the Constitution. Everybody knows what the Second Amendment is. You hear Second Amendment, everybody knows immediately it goes straight to guns. But it doesn't necessarily mean just guns. So let's talk about the history here a little bit. Let's get into the Bible, matter of fact. You know, someone says, well, Doug, do you really believe it's biblical to keep and bear arms and, you know, have a violent thing in your possession and so on? Absolutely. In fact, when Jesus was arrested, did not Peter pull out his knife? And Jesus had told him, have your knife on you. Be carrying your knives, gentlemen. But when Jesus was arrested, Peter pulls out his knife, you know, he lops off the Roman soldier's ear, and Jesus says, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, you know, put away the knife, you know, Peter, this is not the right time. And so it wasn't, well, gosh, you know, Peter, put away that accursed weapon. Why would you have a weapon on you and concealed carry or open carry or whatever? Why would you do such a thing? No, that was not the response. You know, Jesus Christ absolutely said, you know, you have that knife on you. Carry it. You know, that's a good thing. Need you to make sure you're armed. There's a dangerous world out there. So the Bible, in my opinion, hey, if it's good enough for Peter, it's good enough for me, right? Concealed carry. But also, notice, I'm talking about a knife here. Guns, obviously, when we, you know, God created the earth, you know, and this idea of natural law and natural rights and all that is really created, and we are a part of the race of Adam, so those natural rights carry down to all of us. We all have the natural rights equally. God didn't, you know, decide to give, you know, some people some natural rights, other people different natural rights. We all have our natural rights, God-given rights, equally among each. The problem isn't whether or not God gave us our natural rights. It's whether or not government allows us access to our natural rights. So, you know, everybody in China, everybody in Russia, everybody in Iran, Iraq, around the world, Europe, they all have the same natural rights we do. The difference is their government blocks some of those natural rights. And our government's trying to block some of ours. And they belong to us. It's for us to have access to them. But anyway, so then you get back to the Saxon influence on the American system and the English system. The Saxons invaded Britain at one point, and while they didn't achieve their invasion, their takeover the way they expected, well, in other words, the Saxons lost, they integrated into the society. The Britons said, well, you know, you can still be a part of our society, and the Saxon system then also merged into the British society and the English society, and this idea of the right to keep and bear arms, natural law, this idea of innocent until proven guilty, all of that was integrated into the British system. This is what the Saxons believed. And when it came to carrying a weapon, the Saxons got their name from their weapon. They carried what was called a sax on their hip, a blade. And the Romans called them Saxons because of the fact that they carried that blade. And so you have the Saxons, and they have this blade, the sax, and if one of them gets in trouble, he winds up being attainted. In other words, jailed, you've been convicted, you're going to be held for, you know, your crimes or whatever. Your sax is removed from your possession. You don't have your sax. Your sax is your sign of your liberty. Without your sax, you don't have liberty because you're unable to defend your liberty. And you don't get your sax right now because you are convicted and you're being held, you're being attainted by the system that's in place. Then once the Saxon was released, you know, they didn't say, well, I don't know, you got a felony, you might not get to keep it. No, once you were released, once you were free, you received your sax again. Your liberty and your sax were one and one. One were together. So here you are, you've got your sax, you're a free man, and you have the right to keep and bear that sax. And that idea carried over into the English system and over to America. So now we have this idea, this gun culture here that says, hey man, I have a right to keep and bear arms. And the Second Amendment says so. So let's now go through the language of the Second Amendment and really break it down here. So once again, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. A well-regulated militia. What's a militia? Well, the militia then was, or at least what this was referring to, was that armed force that had worked together these farmers, these merchants, these storekeepers, these professionals who were all together as a militia fighting the American Revolution. And this militia was the fighting force, but they were the citizens. It was a citizen army. And they didn't do too well in the very beginning. It was basically an angry mob that couldn't hit the broadside of a barn, and there was bickering among the generals and so on and so forth. So George Washington had to organize them, had to make it a better force. He had to make sure they were put in good order. They weren't in good order. And that gets back to our word regulated, a well-regulated militia. Remember when we were in the Commerce Clause, we talked about the word regulated. And in the Commerce Clause, it talks about regulating the commerce between the states. And so when it comes to a well-regulated militia, same thing. What does the word regulated mean? So we go to our current dictionary, we'll look it up, and it says, oh, to control and restrict through the rule of law. So in other words, Congress can make law to control and restrict. You've heard of federal government regulating things. So when you hear government has a regulatory agency, they're there to regulate. That's your thoughts, right? They're regulating. And so, the word regulate means, in today's dictionary, to control and restrict, for government to have a heavy hand on it. Is that what the founders meant? Well, we go back to the 1828 dictionary, and the 1828 dictionary is a little different. So the today's dictionary, very first definition, control and restrict by rule of law. The second definition is, and the third definition is flow and weights and measures. So flow, you turn on and off the water, you're regulating the flow of the water, right? When it comes to weights and measures, you put sugar in your tea or sugar in your coffee, you're regulating the sweetness of your coffee or your tea. So that's the number two and number three definitions of regulated or regulate. Then we get to today's dictionary, and the least used, or the number four definition, is to put in good order. The word regulate and the word regular is kind of related, and it basically regulate means to make regular, to put in good order. And that's what it says right there in today's dictionary as the fourth, at least used definition. Then we go to the 1828 dictionary. This is the first Webster's dictionary of the American version of English. And Noah Webster felt the necessity to make this dictionary because, number one, the American version of English was slowly departing from being strictly the same as the English version of the English language, number one. And number two, as he wrote in one of his documents, he wanted to make sure people properly understood the Constitution, understood the language. So he wrote this dictionary. And in his dictionary, 1828, Webster's dictionary of the American version of the English language, matter of fact, is titled American Dictionary of the English Language. And in that dictionary, the word regulated is there, but the order of the definitions is a little different. The one that says to regulate the flow or weights and measures, that's the number one definition. People use the word regulated for that than anything else, more than anything else. So now we have our other two. Which comes next, to put in good order or to control and restrict through the rule of law? What comes as the number two definition is to put in good order. The number three definition, the last definition, the least used definition, to control and restrict through the rule of law. So what we're looking at here is a different meaning of the word regulated when they wrote a well-regulated militia. And that makes sense. A well-regulated militia is a militia that's in good order. So when you look at the militia during the Revolutionary War, was it in good order? No, it was in very bad order. The generals were bickering. There was fighting among themselves. They lost 8 of the first 11 battles. They couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. They couldn't march. They didn't have uniforms, so on and so forth. And then near the end of the war, Washington finally decided, you know what? I'm going to organize our fighting force. I'm going to create companies and battalions, and I'm going to have the lower ranking officers have certain powers, and so on and so forth. And that organization made it a better militia, a militia that was in better order, a well-regulated militia. So based on what we saw in the American Revolution, a well-regulated militia, meaning a militia that's in good order, makes all the sense. We have another part of the Constitution that actually also is consistent with this. In Article 1, Section 8, prior to the Second Amendment being even thought of or at least written down, they had already really prepared for it. In Article 1, Section 8, it says that Congress shall have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states, respectively, the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to their discipline prescribed by Congress. So in other words, while the militia belongs to the state, it's up to Congress to put them in good order, to have the rules that regulate them, and so on and so forth. So Congress was given the authority to make a well-regulated militia before those words even appeared in the Second Amendment. So a well-regulated militia being necessary, it's necessary. It's not just a thought. It's not just a recommendation. It's not just, oh gosh, maybe we should, you know, have this. No, it's necessary. Being necessary to the security of a free state, the security, to be secure, to be protected, to make sure they can fight off foes, and it's of a free state, to keep that state free, to keep Massachusetts free, to keep Virginia free, to keep California free. Well, who would try to take away their freedom? Would it be an external enemy? Well, perhaps, but also we have the armed forces also to protect the states and the Union against those types of enemies. So it's almost like, well, then if you have the militia protecting the states, it's almost like you've got double the protection. Why are they needed? You've got the military, because the military is a part of the federal government. This army is a standing army for the federal government. What if the federal government's the enemy? You need to have individual, independent fighting forces for the states to defend against that enemy. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state fits that bill. So, in other words, the purpose of this militia to exist is not just to protect the state from invasion in case of a war, be a part of fighting to keep our freedom against a foreign enemy or enemies that have been encroaching across the border or something like that, or in the case of today's state militia, even to toss sandbags when there's a natural disaster. No, it's also there to protect the state from the tyranny that's potentially there with the federal government, or even, I hate to say this, the state government. It's a well-regulated, well, gosh, Doug, the militia, you're talking, you know, these farmers and these merchants and all that that came together as an organized militia. Well, there's also an unorganized militia. The militia is not just that state militia that you see in the movies with the Pennsylvania, you know, thing on the side of their arm or something. You have the unorganized militia. George Mason was asked after this was all the dust settled on this, hey, George, who's the militia? He said, the whole of the people and a few politicians. So we're all part of that militia, some of it organized, some of it unorganized. And so we have a well-regulated militia, a militia that's in good order, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people. It doesn't say the collective right. It doesn't say the right of the community. It doesn't say the right of the groups. It says the right of the people. It is an individual right that each of us has independently, individually. We, as an independent individual person, can have a gun regardless of any other reason. It is our right. The right of the people, not the right of the community, the right of the people. It's not a collective right, it's an individual right. I know there's a lot out there who are saying, well, Doug, you know, because a militia is mentioned, it's a really a collective right. No. The right of the people, the language is about as clear as it can get, to keep and bear arms. To keep arms is to have, to possess, to own, to have them in your home, to have them with you, whatever. To keep, to have, to possess. And bear arms. Remember that 1828 dictionary I talked about earlier? You look up the word bear, and it says, I believe it's after the seventh definition, as an example, as to keep a gun under one's coat or inside one's coat. In other words, to bear arms is to conceal carry. To bear arms is to conceal carry. So to keep and bear arms is to own and conceal carry. So at what point, if that shall not be infringed, which are the final words of the Second Amendment, at what point then does the federal government have the authority to do anything that infringes on my right to possess, to own, and to bear whatever arm I want to bear? Well, Doug, you know, you think they have the authority then to let you go around carrying nuclear weapons? Well, and I hear that all the time. So, well, no, the federal government can't make a law against that. Now, that's where we get the states. The states have the authority to make laws regarding guns. The federal government does not, shall not be infringed, applies to the federal government. Remember in the preamble of the Bill of Rights, we read about this last week, it says that the conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, the federal government. The Bill of Rights is to the federal government saying, we don't trust you. So we're going to come up with this Bill of Rights telling you, you can't touch these rights. None of your business. Don't do anything. Don't touch. Those are our rights. So you get back now to, well, gosh, Doug, but then you said the states can make laws regarding our rights. If there are rights, government should keep their hands off them completely. Well, not necessarily. Federalist 45, James Madison. The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Now, it says the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution. In other words, these powers that the federal government has are delegated by the Constitution. They must be in there. If they're not in there, they don't have the authority. They don't have the power. Now, some says, well, Doug, what's the difference between a power and authority? A power is something that they do. An authority is something that's authorized. So, all authorities are powers, but not all powers are authorities. The government exercises a number of powers that they're not authorized to have. All right, so now we get to the 10th Amendment. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So here in the 10th Amendment, it says the powers are delegated to the United States government. Here in Federalist 45, it says the powers are delegated by the Constitution to the federal government. So any power that the federal government has, in order for it to be legitimate, in order for it to be legal, it must be authorized by the Constitution. It must be an expressly enumerated power. And so when it comes to that in the Constitution, then if it's not expressly enumerated, well, okay, so is any authority over guns expressly enumerated to the federal government in the Constitution? No. And in fact, not only is that power not delegated, it says shall not be infringed. None of your business. Hands off. Every single federal gun law is unconstitutional. And so we go back to the states. Let's continue to read. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. The states, to remain with the states, and we'll see the word reserve later, the states had all the powers ahead of time, and they remain numerous and indefinite. There's no end to them. Going back to the 10th Amendment, if it's going to be a power of the federal government, it's enumerated. If it's not a power of the state, then it will be prohibited to the states in the Constitution. If it's not listed in the Constitution, it's a state power. It's reserved to them. They have all of them, except for those that are given to the federal government or those which are prohibited to them by the Constitution. The former will be exercised principally on external objects as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce, with which the last power of taxation will, for the most part, be connected. The federal government's authorities are the external stuff. We're a country, according to the Constitution now. The states are no longer their little individual, little entities that make all the rules for themselves. They have to operate as a country. You want to make a treaty, you don't send 50 different ambassadors off to negotiate that treaty. You want a head of state, a figurehead, that's going to do the negotiating for the country to represent all of the states. And so the federal government exists, and the president can go negotiate the treaty, and he can sign the treaty. But because the states are the parties to the contract, the Constitution, they still need to ratify it. They are still required to ratify the Constitution. Well, Doug, how can the states ratify the Constitution? I thought that was up to Senate. Right. The U.S. Senate has the authority to ratify, and before the 17th Amendment, the senators were appointed by the state legislature. So the states were the ones that were ratifying the treaties. And now what we've got is we've got a democratically elected Senate, 17th Amendment, and that messes everything up because now we don't have the states being that final oversight over treaties anymore like they originally intended. The states were supposed to be the oversight over everything the federal government did. Those mechanisms have been chipped away. They've been whittled away. They're no longer in existence. All right, let's continue. Then it says in Federalist 45 by James Madison, The powers reserved to the several states will extend to all the objects in the ordinary course of affairs concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. So the powers reserved to the several states, reserved means they're hanging on to it. It was originally their powers. They're hanging on to them. They're reserved to them. Will extend to all the objects, everything that has to do with, in the ordinary course of affairs of the state, concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people. That's your rights. So it's saying here, the states can make some laws regarding your rights. And that's a good thing. It's like, let's get back to the Second Amendment now. Shall not be infringed. Doug, you know, they can't make any laws. Well, federal government can't. The Second Amendment was originally intended only to apply to the federal government. This incorporation of the Bill of Rights, 14th Amendment, I'm not necessarily in agreement with that. And that's a debate for another time. But from the original point of view, the original intent by the Founding Fathers, the Bill of Rights applied to the federal government, not to the states, and the federal government is not to be the enforcer of the Bill of Rights against the states. The states can make the law. Well, gosh, Doug, then you've got laws that are going to go out of control, like California, who's making all of these horrible laws regarding guns. You're right. Yeah, they are. And we're supposed to be in control of that. We are supposed to stop that. We are supposed to, as a people, make sure our state behaves. Pull out the people that are jerks, put in the right people, whatever it takes. That's our job, not the Constitution's job, not the federal government's job. I don't want the federal government dictating to my state. Like we got McDonald v. Chicago, where Chicago was banning handguns. McDonald sued the city of Chicago, worked its way up the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says, hey, you know, you can't ban handguns because the Second Amendment shall not be infringed. And so Chicago was told by the Supreme Court they could not ban handguns. And everybody got a hold of me and said, hey, Doug, man, what a win for gun rights. How awesome is that, Doug? And I'm like, well, don't be so sure, because think about what just happened. The federal government, through the Supreme Court, dictated to a city what it could or could not do regarding your gun rights. Now, while they may have come to the right conclusion this time, can you guarantee that they're going to continue to? Do you really want the federal government dictating to your local government what they can or can't do regarding your gun rights? No, I'm going to dictate to them. Us as a people are supposed to. Now, what if the people make the wrong choice? Well, then we're going to have to either fight to change it, put up a shut up, or move to a state or a city that's going to be more in tune with what we believe. That's the wonderful thing about the states and the cities being unique, individual, and being able to take care of their own business. If you don't like what's going on, change it or move. And you can vote with your feet. So, powers reserved in several states will extend to all the objects in which the ordinary course of affairs concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people. Your rights, it's just like you have a right to go through the intersection. Government doesn't put up a stoplight, take away your right to go through the intersection, but to make sure that it happens in an orderly fashion, because your right to go through that intersection stops at the next car's bumper. He has a right to go to that intersection too. If you guys are bashing into each other, we got a problem. Nobody's getting their right. So stoplights are put in to ensure that everybody's going through in an orderly fashion. Everybody's able to obtain their opportunity to access their right to go through the intersection. You know, I have a right to swing my arms. My right to swing my arms stops at the tip of your nose. So I'm supposed to be responsible with my right. But if I punch you in the nose, government then has a law that says, hey, you interfered with his right. He had a right not to be punched in the nose. And so then the person who causes the violence is attainted. They are go through the due process. And then if convicted, then they are imprisoned or fined or whatever. But that's how it works. But they're not supposed to make a law not allowing me to swing my arms. I've got the right to swing my arms. I just don't have the right to punch someone in the nose. I'm supposed to be responsible for my right to swing my arms. So the powers reserved to several states will extend to all the objects which in the ordinary course of affairs concern the lives, liberties, properties of the people. Once again, Federalist 45 by James Madison. And the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. Internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. So the internal order, the internal improvement, that would be taking care of its own business. The state's job is to take care of its own infrastructure, to pay for its own roads, to build its own bridges. It's not the federal government's job. They don't have the authority. So this idea of federal funding going to roads and all that is totally unconstitutional. It's up to the state to handle its internal affairs, its internal improvements, and so on and so forth. And And matter of fact, 1817, bonus bill vetoed by the president of the United States at the time, James Madison, he says exactly that. Hey, Congress says with the bonus bill, we want to pay for roads and boatways, well, because, you know, military equipment might need a canal to go through or to use the roads. And besides, it's for the general welfare. And James Madison says, no, first of all, we have military equipment that's not supposed to be traversing in the countryside in that manner. Second of all, that's not the primary reason for the roads. Primary reason for the roads are for the states. If the military is going to use it, so be it. But that doesn't mean we have the authority to start funding it. Besides, general welfare, that's not a clause of an excuse to make a law. It's a condition that's met in case if the federal government's doing its job. So the general welfare clause does not mean excuse. If that's what it means, then we no longer have a limited government. We have a Congress that can make any law it wants, and that's not what we meant when we wrote the Constitution. This is what the father of the Constitution, James Madison, is saying to them in the 1817 bonus bill veto that he wrote. Now back to Federalist 45, James Madison. The operations of the federal government will be most extensive and important in times of war and danger, those of the state governments in times of peace and security. So the states handle their internal stuff, the federal government handles the external stuff. In Article 1, Section 4, if you remember, there's a part of the Constitution that says, hey, Congress shall meet at least once per year. And there were those that actually argued that was too often. That was too much. What are we going to do unless we're at war? There's nothing to do. The federal government's job is so restricted domestically, unless we're at war, there's nothing to do. I've got a farm to take care of. I've got a practice to maintain. I've got a store to keep. I don't have time for this. That was the attitude, because the federal government had very few authorities. And so, now getting back to our Second Amendment, so well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Federal government has no authority to make any gun law, even background checks. Now, if a state wants to do that, they have the authority. Whether or not they ought to, that's a discussion for another time. But they do have that authority. Well, gosh, Doug, well, then what you're saying is the state can stomp all over my rights. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that they can put in stoplights. They can pass laws that says that a 9-year-old can't go buy a gun. Or if they decide a felon shouldn't be able to own a gun, that's their authority to do so. I mean, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. Even in the Saxon system, once a prisoner was set free, he was able to get his sacks back on his hip. That's a different story for a different time. So we've got this state government, then it might go out of control. Well, the delegates of the Constitution weren't worried about the states. Delegates of the Congress that, you know, was a part of the Bill of Rights, they weren't worried about the states. That was them. They trusted themselves. They didn't trust the federal government, so they're telling the federal government, shall not be infringed. If anybody's going to take care of this gun thing, it's going to be us. And that's where it should be, at the local level. But what if they go too far? What if they go beyond what should be constitutionally authorized? And in California especially, there's no gun safety, gun rights, gun anything language in the California state constitution. So what do we do? Well, when California's out of control, we get a handle on it as a people. We need to get the language in our state constitution we want to get in there. We need to pull out the knuckleheads, replace them. Well, Doug, it's out of control. Well, then move somewhere else. And the state will then start falling apart. Eventually, they'll get themselves in play. So you have a choice, at your state level when it comes to state issues, with state laws. You know, you can put up and shut up. You can fight to change it, or you can vote with your feet and move somewhere that agrees with what you have to say or what you feel about a particular issue. Second Amendment being exactly that same thing. So well-regulated militia that's in good order. Remember, we've got the dictionaries, right? We have the original dictionary of 1828, and we have today's dictionary. Today's dictionary, well-regulated militia, the word regulated means to put in good order. So militia, the well-regulated militia, is militia that's in good order. It's necessary for the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms. To keep is to own. To bear is to, conceal carry. And so we have these constitutional carry laws that have gone through the states. 24 states, I believe it is now, has constitutional carry laws where you don't need a permit to conceal carry. That's constitutional. You have the right to keep and bear arms. and it shall not be infringed. Well, gosh, Doug, you know, aren't you nervous about all those dangerous guns out there? No, because it's not dangerous people carrying them. And if there are dangerous people out there carrying them, the not dangerous people carrying them also are armed, and the dangerous people are going to think twice before they pull theirs out and do something stupid because they don't know who's armed. And the one thing I've learned about criminals is they don't want to die either. They don't want to be shot either. And so when you have a society that's armed, it keeps the crime down. And the Second Amendment allows for that, to keep and bear arms. Not just for crime, though, but also because, remember, we've got this central government that might turn against us. So we need to be armed to stand against that. So a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear, to conceal carry arms shall not be infringed. States can make some laws. States are not supposed to go too far, and it is our job to maintain control over our state in case it starts to do that. So there's our Second Amendment. That's the basic information. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this break, and then we're going to continue on into the Third Amendment and so on and so forth. Don't go anywhere. Mr. Constitution Hour by Douglas V. Gibbs on K-Praise, your San Diego Christian station, and it's out there on, and welcome if you're listening to iHeart and Odyssey and Spotify. I'm on all those and more. There's like 8 platforms. Welcome to the program. Glad you're listening there. If you didn't know that my shows are on all those platforms, check it out. You can also go to douglasvgibbs.com to find my podcast link for the station and more. I also have a radio show on KMET on Saturdays from 1 to 3. So check it out, douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com. Don't go anywhere. We're going to take a real quick break, and then when we come back, we'll start talking about the Third Amendment. Stay tuned. Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. Radical, powerful, enlightening. The journey of America is a tale that needs to be heard, and Mr. Constitution tells it each week on the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, Saturdays at 9 p.m. Pacific on K-Praise, San Diego's Salem Media radio station for Christian programming, FM 106.1 in North County, AM 1210 in San Diego, and online for the world at kprz.com. Douglas V. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution. You know, I spent 20 years in the construction industry, and now that I'm no longer in the industry, I still feel like I'm always building. But instead of building homes or doing the things that make a home larger or better, I'm doing it with the constitutional education endeavor that I'm involved in. So we are currently building and enhancing what we do. All we need is help from you. Let us know what you think of the website as it grows. Send us an email at douglasvgibbs@ilj.com, or if you want to help fund our efforts, you can go to douglasvgibbs.com or politicalpistachio.com and hit the donate button and contribute to the effort. We want to make this as big as possible. We want to get the word out about the Constitution. We want it to spread to all the minds in this country so that we can turn this back around, restore our republic, restore our Constitution, and be back on the right footing. douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com. Hi, my name is Douglas V. Gibbs. I am known as Mr. Constitution out there, and I have been an instructor on the U.S. Constitution since 2008, and I've been studying the document my entire life. I have written 8 books out there, and the latest being Creator, the first 125 myths of the United States Constitution. All of the books, each of them have important messages to give. All of them are about the Constitution except for one of them. One of them is called Silenced Screams, Abortion in a Virtuous Society. That's my only non-constitutional book, and even it has a constitutional angle to it when you read it. All of them are available at douglasvgibbs.com/store. I would appreciate if you purchase the books. I would hope you would learn from them. All I ask is that in return you let me know, and I would love to autograph the books. If you buy them from the store, they will be autographed. So thanks for being a part of this program on K-Praise, and let's read about the Constitution and be informed. creator by Douglas V. Gibbs, is on sale now. His eighth book, A True Action Plan for Christians When It Comes to Restoring the Republic. The keystone of American liberty is the Creator. Without a godly foundation, like an arch without its keystone, our whole system comes crumbling down. Thanks to age-old ideologies and an ancient lust for power and wealth, once again, our world is upside down. Evil has become good, and good has become evil. The churches have been infiltrated, and the rule of law has been replaced by the rule of man. To restore our liberty and the virtuous nature of our country, we must understand what is happening and what to do. Creator is a book that illuminates the realities that swirl around the foundation of American liberty and addresses seven critical issues directly related to our system of liberty that we must understand, address, and fight. For if we are to reestablish our American way of life on a foundation and cornerstone based on the Founding Fathers' beliefs in our Creator, and as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That was in the Declaration of Independence, and now our time has come upon us. Now it is our turn. How do we address what is going on? What are the true causes of the rise of tyranny in America? What steps must we take as a people to keep the republic? It all begins with our Creator. On sale now by Douglas V. Gibbs. Learn more at Amazon.com or DouglasVGibbs.com/store.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on KPRZ, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. Okay, so welcome back, Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution Hour by Douglas V. Gibbs on KPRZ, KPRZ, 1210 AM, 106.1 FM. And so we talked about the Second Amendment. We've gotten through that. If you missed it in the first half of this program, or a little bit more than half of Second Amendment, you can go check it out again. We've got a podcast page, iHeartRadio, all of that. But let's get into the Third Amendment. And I actually want to stop here for a second and really talk about these amendments again, the Bill of Rights. And I think we went over this last week, but it bears repeating. So we've got language in the Bill of Rights that tells us that it's not telling government to protect our rights or to guarantee our rights, but to secure our rights and hands off our rights. It's negative language. You know, I remember Barack Obama during his presidency complained that the Bill of Rights and then the Constitution was a document of negative rights, he called it. It tells the federal government what it can't do, not what it should do. And actually, that's not the way the Constitution works. It tells the federal government what its authorities are, and if it's not listed, they don't have an authority. But then in the Bill of Rights, it does say, oh, by the way, you can't do this. But it's a good thing. It's telling you, it's telling the federal government not that it should be trying to control things or sending you a welfare check or whatever, but that not to do things. First words of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law. Last words of the Second Amendment, shall not be infringed. First words of the Third Amendment, no soldier shall, the middle of the Fourth Amendment, shall not be violated. That is not language saying that they're there to protect or to guarantee our rights. It's language telling government, hands off our rights. None of your business. Don't touch. It's our rights. Stay away from them. And so we get into our Amendment 3, and this is an interesting one because people don't think it applies anymore. Well, because, see, the history behind the Third Amendment, gets back to the writs of assistance. I don't know if you've heard of James Otis. James Otis goes back to, I think it was 1760-something when he spoke. 1762, I want to say. And he was a governor of Massachusetts, and the idea of the writs of assistance came down, and he stood against them. Now, a writ of assistance, what the writs of assistance were, is that's a general warrant. That was basically saying, British troops, you have a warrant here. It's a writ of assistance to search any home at any time for any reason. You don't need a specific reason. We just know that these colonists are doing stuff they shouldn't be doing. They've got the contraband from, you know, inside their homes because they've been not buying British products, and we passed that law that they can only have British products. And so the writ of assistance, you can search any home at any time, rip the cupboards up, you know, floorboards up, searching for this stuff. And that's the way it is. And James Otis gave a 5-hour speech about why they were wrong, that he wasn't going to uphold the writs of assistance. He refused to enforce them. He was going to stand against the British Empire, and everybody else should too. Everybody should resist this tyranny. And during that speech, and James Otis really is the grandfather of the Declaration of Independence, the grandfather of the American Revolution. And when John Adams said in a quote after the revolution that the revolution had existed long before the first shots were fired, that the revolution existed in the hearts and the souls of the people, what he was referring to partly was James Otis. 25-year-old John Adams was in the audience when James Otis delivered that speech. I think I told a class he was 21, but he's actually 25. I looked it up later and realized I was off by a few years. But John Adams, young John Adams, 25, watching James Otis, and it was stirring the revolution. It was saying, we're not going to put up with this tyranny anymore. And so the writs of assistance were rejected by James Otis early. And so the Founding Fathers, when they wrote this Constitution, they were familiar with the writs of assistance. This was something they were familiar with, and they were going to make sure it wasn't going to happen in the colonies, or in the states, should I say, the United States of America. So in the Constitution, they wrote the Third Amendment. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house. So not only were the writs of assistance allowing them to search houses, but during the tumultuous times, they were also ordered to quarter these troops, these people who would rip up their floorboards and were the enemy. And now they've got to allow them in their home, to quarter them, take care of them, you know, give them a bed to sleep in, and so, you know, feed them, whatever. The enemy is inside your house, and you're required to do it by law. That was what quartering was. No soldier shall, in this Third Amendment, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war. So, in other words, whether we're in peace or we're in war, we are not going to be required to keep troops in our house, standing army, whatever. Then it says, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. In other words, Congress is going to have the authority that if there's going to be a time in which there can be the quartering, it's going to follow that law. And there are laws. The agencies, the federal agencies, the ATF and drug enforcement and all of that, that all falls under the federal umbrella, and that all falls under this. Basically, the federal operators, the federal personnel, the federal soldiers, federal agency agents, federal whatever, FBI, you name it, they're not supposed to operate in your state or your county without your constitutional sheriff's permission. And then on top of that, they can't use your home unless you say it's okay. So there was this case in Colorado years and years ago, and I want to say it was the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, which is an unconstitutional agency, but that's a discussion for another time. And what's going on is the agents, the FBI agents and the Drug Enforcement Agency agents, they want to surveil a particular house, this guy who's known for doing all these different things. They need to get some surveillance. They need to get some evidence. They need to get some proof. And so they go to the homeowner, it's like across the street or something like that, and they say, hey, you know, we're going to use your house as, you know, for as a surveillance post, and so we can keep an eye on this guy. And the guy says, no, I don't want you in my home. They kick in the door, they arrest the guy for refusal, and he sues them, and he uses the Third Amendment. and he won. That's an example. They cannot use your home without your consent. They cannot be quartered in your home. They cannot surveil from your home. All of that. You have the right to say no if that is the case. If you've got federal agents saying, hey, we're going to use your house, like it or not. No, it isn't a like it or not. You will not. I don't have to. You are not allowed to do it without my consent. So that's the Third Amendment. Let's go on to the Fourth Amendment now. Now, the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments are the legal amendments. So the first three amendments, Amendment 1, 2, and 3, those are your individual rights, your personal individual rights. 4 through 8, those are your legal rights. Then Amendment 9 is all other rights. And then Amendment 10 is states' rights. Now, I was talking to someone not too long ago, and they didn't like the term states' rights. Because, you know, the states are not an individual. God didn't give the states their rights. Well, the states are, we populate our states. The states have rights because they're our rights as a group. In other words, group rights. And so when it comes to our states do have rights because we have rights and we populate our states. That's what states' rights means. Then another person might say, well, gosh, Doug, states' rights, that's, you know, what caused the Civil War. Do you really want to, you know, go down that path? You know, don't you think that's a trigger for racism and all that? No, it's not. And in fact, the war between the states was not initially fought over slavery. And we'll get, when we get to Amendments 13 through 15, we'll get more into detail here. But let me, someone says, well, wait a second, it was all about slavery. No, it wasn't. It was about states' rights. It was about states feeling that they, that the contract had been breached. In fact, if you read the Constitution of the Confederate States of America, they put it in the very beginning. Hey, our contract was breached. The northern states, the Union, was not following the Constitution. And so as sovereign states, we have the right to secede. We have, and we're out of there. We're no longer under that contract. That was the reason. Obviously, slavery was an ingredient, but the reason really was slavery. And I'll show you some evidence. And we'll talk about this again on another episode, but I want to go over this real quick. So when the states seceded, they all seceded after the election of Lincoln in 1860, but before he was inaugurated in March. And during that time period, inauguration back then was in March. So from November to March, all of those states that were going to secede, seceded from the Union. And so the America that Lincoln was voted into and the America that he was inaugurated into are two different Americas. And they were out of there. They left the Union. And there were some of the states that were slave states that while they wanted to defend their slavery, they were against secession. That would be Tennessee and Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware. And then when Virginia seceded, there were 13 counties in Virginia said, we're against secession. We want to be a part of the Union. I mean, we're a slaves state area, but we don't want to be in secession. We don't want to be separated from the Constitution of the United States and the Union. So those 13 states seceded from Virginia, which was now outside the Constitution because they had seceded. So didn't need Virginia's legislature's permission to secede. And those counties said, we're out of here. We're seceding. And so they separated from Virginia. Then they reapplied as a state to the Union, West Virginia. That's how West Virginia came into being. But notice, get back to my point that the war between states was not about slavery per se. Part of our evidence of that, aside from the language in the Confederate States Constitution, is West Virginia. West Virginia applied back to the Union as a slave state, and they were accepted as a slave state. In fact, Tennessee, Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware, and West Virginia were all slave states at the beginning of the war between the states. So we have to understand that when it comes to slavery, slavery was an issue, was an ingredient, but it was not the reason, the primary reason. It really didn't become the reason for the war until the Emancipation Proclamation, at which time Lincoln wrote the delivered the Emancipation Proclamation basically as a political tactic to let Europe know, hey, this war is now all about slavery. That's what I'm saying with the Emancipation Proclamation. The citizens of the European countries got upset, and then Europe pulled their fleets away from the war, and that enabled the blockade against the northern fleet into the southern ports to be stopped. And then Charleston, New Orleans, all of that was attacked, and before long, the tide of the war changed into the favor of the Union. So that's all of that. Okay, now, real quick, because we don't have a whole lot of time here, I want to get started on the Amendment 4, maybe even go through all of it. The right of the people. Now, remember, Second Amendment, right of the people. So this is an individual right. It's saying right here, it's a right. You have this right because God gave it to you. Government has no business being involved. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizure shall not be violated. You have a right not to be searched and seized in an unreasonable manner. Now, if it's reasonable, they've got a probable cause or something like that, then they have the warrant issued, and then they can reasonably search. But just to kick you in the doors and start searching and, tough cookies, no, it can't happen. Or at least not with the federal government. With the state constitution has similar language. They're not really supposed to do it either. It is your right. It is your right not to be searched and seized in an unreasonable manner. So the right of the people to be secure in their persons, that's you as an individual, houses, your abode, papers, that includes your computer paperwork. In other words, your electronic papers, your emails, your documents that you've saved, and so on and so forth. And effects. Effects is everything else. So your persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. They are not supposed to search. They're not supposed to have a warrant to search unless there's probable cause. Probable cause meaning there's some evidence that you do have the contraband or whatever it is that they're looking for. Then it says, supported by oath or affirmation. So an oath is to God, affirmation is to affirm, and means by the judge. The judge is going to issue this warrant. There's going to be an oath or affirmation by the officer saying, this is what we need. I swear this is the truth. We have probable cause. And then it says, describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So they can't say, oh, we just know there's stuff in there somewhere. It doesn't work that way. No, this is the item. We believe it's stored at this portion of the house. They don't necessarily have to be exactly right, but they at least have to have a good idea what it is they're looking for, where it's at. And they know this because of the evidence, the probable cause. Without the probable cause, well, then you don't go any further than that. So there you go. Thank you for listening. We are out of time. I appreciate the fact that you are part of this this broadcast here on K-Praise, and thank you for spending the time. So we've gone through the Second, the Third, and the Fourth Amendment. We'll start with Amendment 5 next week, and each week here on K-Praise, Mr. Constitution Hour, Douglas V. Gibbs. Thank you for paying attention. Thank you for being a part of it. DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye now.
General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.